This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of October 1st, here are some top stories.
The Arizona State Fair starts today, and if you are a fan, there's probably something that you enjoy the most. Maybe it's the baby animals or the rides. Maybe it's the giant glistening turkey legs. But for thousands of people across the state, the fair is all about the thrill of competition. KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports.
Best dollhouse. Best pet fashion. Best decorative egg. If you can imagine it, there is probably a category for it at the Arizona State Fair. And Mary Ellen Simmons totally wants you to enter.
You know, just imagine you could say in casual conversation, every chance you get, did you know that I have something at the fair, on display at the fair?
On display in this cavernous exhibit hall, which becomes Simmons' second home every October. But she's not just a decades-long employee here. She sees herself as an ambassador, always eager to bring people into the fair fold.
I'm pumped about the fair. I mean, I can't think of anywhere that you couldn't talk about the fair.
Even a funeral. Simmons says she was once asked to speak at a memorial service for a fair employee, her friend Joffrey.
And I said, you know, in his honor, and I thought, do I have nerve enough to do this? Yes, I do. In his honor, could you enter something in the fair?
She got a few raised eyebrows and several new fair participants. Simmons also runs an outreach program that ensures that all of Arizona's 15 counties are represented at the state fair's competitive exhibits. Norma Wade, who lives outside of Globe, helps with the program and knows that sometimes people just need a little bit of convincing.
I think most of them feel like I used to. My stuff's really not good enough to put in the fair. But that's really wrong.
It's opening day at the Gila County Fair, and Wade is standing next to a table blanketed with colorful crocheted afghans.
And this is mine, and this is mine, and this is mine, and this one, and this one.
And some will go to the state fair, too. Wade, who's 76, says she never thought about entering any fair until she retired and moved to Globe a few years back. She remembers how she felt walking into this exhibit hall and seeing her work on display for the first time.
I was amazed. Amazed. Like, oh. Because that first year I got a blue ribbon on everything.
It's the kind of recognition people of all ages are chasing.
I like to go fast because it's easier for me. If I could go faster than this, I would.
12-year-old Hannah Weisenborn is feeding bright orange fabric with zebras on it through a sewing machine in her kitchen in Florence. She'll have more than 30 items in the fair this year, mostly vibrant pillows.
I'm nervous and excited at the same time. Because, like, you never know what's going to happen. So, like, yeah.
No one ever does, which is part of what makes the fair so addictive.
Hi, come on in.
Mary Ellen Simmons is welcoming a constant stream of people into the exhibit hall at the Arizona State Fairgrounds. They've got garbage bags, cardboard boxes, and rolling luggage, all full of work, ready to be judged.
My name is Tina. I'm from Avondale, and I brought in two knitted shawls to exhibit.
My name is Ken, and I'm bringing a cross-stitch.
My name is Samantha Aldritz. I'm from Gilbert, and I have a giant crocheted stegosaurus in my hands at the moment.
Plus a dragon in the car. Angela Eshelman is carefully placing a family of sock monkeys onto an empty table. There's one dressed like a pumpkin, also a rodeo clown. And there's an especially ornate monkey with long hair, leather pants, and a bracelet that says crazy.
This is Steven Tyler from Aerosmith.
The fair is Eshelman's favorite time of year, and not just because she's won big before. These monkeys are a tribute to her grandmother, who made them for all her grandchildren.
I hope she looks down from heaven and smiles.
And this year, she hopes her grandmother sees a bright blue ribbon around Steven Tyler's neck. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News.
Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, here's co-host Lauren Gilger.
In the 1980s, the concrete wall that divided the German city of Berlin still stood. On the east side, the German Democratic Republic carried forth the Soviet Union's agenda until it was toppled in 1990 as the Cold War came to a close. In his new book, Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution and the Fall of the Berlin Wall, music journalist Tim Moore uncovers the little-known story of a group of punk rockers in East Berlin whose teenage rebellion became the spark that proved the power of the resistance. I spoke with Moore and Moore about this, and he told me at the time in East Germany there was an officially sanctioned music scene that was mostly dominated by bands that tried to sound like Deep Purple. But his story begins with a small group of teenagers there who heard the Sex Pistols on Western radio.
That flipped the switch for them. It was as if they felt the Pistols were saying things and articulating in ways that they'd always wanted to but hadn't thought to yet. And that was the spark for most of these kids to get into punk.
So you were in Berlin not long after all of this happened. In 1992, you said you got there. Tell us about how you found out about this group of teens and how you uncovered this story.
I was pretty clueless. I was kind of a typical American in that I thought Germany and Oktoberfest were basically the same thing. And I expected to get out of the plane in Berlin and see everybody in lederhosen swinging those giant 1 liter beers around. And instead, I landed in a high rise complex out in the far east part of the city. It was a big gray building surrounded by a bunch of other big gray buildings. And it was near the East Berlin Zoo, so you'd hear the howling animals at night. So it was very different from Oktoberfest, obviously, and I was kind of disappointed at first. But then I discovered this whole scene that was happening over there. If you went into the central parts of East Berlin in the old, basically empty, dilapidated buildings, there were a lot of squats and a lot of interesting bars and clubs and galleries going in. So behind these great facades, you had just an unbelievably colorful scene taking off, and I ended up DJing in that scene for most of the 90s. And by coincidence then, meeting people who'd been part of the East German punk resistance. So I landed amongst them, coincidentally. And then eventually, once I become friends with some of these people, I was shown things that they'd kept hidden during the course of the dictatorship. There was one guy in particular who had a false bottom drawer during the dictatorship, and he'd been the guitarist in one of the early East Berlin bands. And he showed me eventually a few lyric sheets and photos of his friends. And I realized that this was something special and something basically invisible. It was a scene that no one had learned about. I guess primarily because it wasn't covered in the Eastern media, because the Eastern media didn't acknowledge oppositional type voices. And for ideological reasons, the punks had never sought attention in the Western media the way a lot of other opposition groups did.
Tell us more about this particular group and how dangerous this was for them at the time, right? Like, how dangerous was it to be in the punk scene at all or to be rebellious in that way?
The first punk in East Berlin was a 15-year-old girl, and she went by the name Major. And it didn't take long for the Stasi to consider it a threat. One of the surprises for me in the research process was seeing the level of paranoia of the secret police towards this movement really quickly. And, of course, I realized as I got deeper into it that they were correct, basically. So eventually the Stasi, which is the name of the secret police, put in a major crackdown. And the punks ended up in jail, subject to daily detainment and arrest and beatings. What happened was the punks, they kept fighting. They basically, a lot of them would go to jail, come back out, put the leather jacket on and keep going. And that changed the game because other opposition-minded people could see that it was possible to resist and survive. That was a game-changing realization for the whole opposition scene. So yeah. I think that leads to then, in the second half of the 80s, people taking the protests out into the streets and into the public eye, and that's how it's able to then snowball into the mass demonstrations that we know from 1989.
So this sort of small group of what started as just, you know, teenage rebels really, you think, sparked something that really ended up being incredibly historically influential?
Yeah, they lost their fear of the police and of the secret police, and they steeled the resolve of a lot of the other opposition-minded people. All of these groups ended up interacting under the umbrella of the church. The church was a safe space. They had a special status that didn't allow uniformed security forces to come into the churches. So all the punk concerts took place in churches. And that's also, since they were harboring peace activists and human rights activists, how these groups ended up finding common purpose. And also the other groups saw the extreme treatment that the punks were subject to and the fact that they were still surviving and continuing to fight. And that was the key, I think.
Let's talk a little bit about the music in this, right? This is also about music. Are there some songs or some bands that are really emblematic of this?
Not really. They were all barred from the state media system, so they couldn't record, they couldn't distribute anything, they couldn't get on the radio, and it was dangerous to even have your music heard in a lot of cases. I mean, as a musical phenomenon, it pretty much disappeared. On November 9th, 1989, the night that the wall fell, one of these bands was playing a show, and towards the end of their set, the crowd started to go crazy, and the band couldn't understand what's going on. They didn't know whether they were playing particularly well that night or whatever. And they come down off the stage, and they're told the wall's fallen, and they broke the band up that night. Basically, they knew that the goal had been achieved, and that in the future, the message and the music itself was going to have to change to fit new political realities.
Yeah. So it sounds like it started maybe about music, but it was about much more than that, clearly. Do you think that there's still a little bit of that true spirit in punk rock today, or do you think that this has been lost? I mean, I guess since this was not like a widely known story, and you're sort of uncovering it, I wonder if you listen to punk rock music today and feel like it's a shell.
I think there was something magical about the way they couched their message in this really aggressive, energetic music. I think it's not coincidental. And sometimes after shows, people would literally run out of the churches and start spraying oppositional graffiti on walls. So there was definitely a magic to that mix. I think they basically came up with a sort of a handbook for resisting authoritarianism that would have to be created in other ways for other settings, including, you know, I see one of the interesting things about working on the book for so long, it took me about 10 years to do the research and find all the people I needed to talk to.
Yeah.
And over that time, it went from what was basically to me a fascinating story to something that was almost frighteningly relevant, because during that time, you had the Snowden revelations of our own mass surveillance, and you saw the militarization of our police and the drastic reaction to protesters here in the States from Black Lives Matter and the pipeline activists. And so I don't think there's a direct analog. It's not like we need to give a bunch of kids guitars and see what happens.
Right.
But I do think the idea of youth activism, of grassroots movements making a concrete change in society that this is a historical example of, I think that's an important thing to have out there in the world at the moment.
All right. Tim Moore is a music journalist and the author of Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. Tim, thanks so much for coming on the show to talk about this.
Thanks a lot, Lauren.
It says a round sound in a two-inch wall.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the Business Desk. Once a quiet college town in the mountains, Flagstaff has become a bustling city that has no place to grow. The Arizona Board of Regents set a goal for Northern Arizona University to increase enrollment to 35,000 students by 2025. The school's currently on track to meet that goal, but many Flagstaff locals are feeling the growing pains. KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
Matt and Olivia McReynolds met when they were students at Northern Arizona University more than a decade ago.
I remember the sticker shock of paying $900 a month for a one-bedroom apartment.
And you had to sell your Isuzu Trooper, and that summer I had to get a job and work all night.
To afford that rent.
Just to make rent, we had to sell, yeah.
They moved away and came back twice, because they love the peaks, the change of seasons, and now the schools for their three kids.
I'm an attorney, and I make decent money. And it's puzzling that even, you know, despite that, this is what we're able to afford in Flagstaff.
This is a tiny two-bedroom apartment for a family of five. From where we're sitting on the love seat, because a full couch wouldn't fit, you can almost see the entire apartment.
We are around 500 square feet, and we're paying over $1,600 a month.
$1,600.
Yes.
For 500 square feet.
Yes.
Even I'm surprised, and I've lived here for 15 years. But during that time, Northern Arizona University has doubled in size. Many people in Flagstaff feel whiplashed by the rate of growth. In addition to steep home prices, locals gripe about the traffic, the parking, and the threat of losing the quintessential historic charm that makes Flagstaff unique. Flagstaff's mayor, Coral Evans, is an alumna of NAU. She lives in a home built by her grandfather just 3 blocks from campus, so she has to deal with students partying at all hours.
I live in a house that my grandfather built that I am proud to live in. And I got told the other day that I should move if I didn't like it.
But she says she couldn't afford to move if she wanted to.
Because with the growth of the university came the ridiculous prices for the housing in this city, with absolutely no relief.
But Evans says it's not NAU's fault. If we're pointing fingers, point them at the state lawmakers who took away university funding. The 3 state universities receive only 18% of their revenue from the state general fund. To compensate, enrollment has gone up and so has tuition. Emily Allen is a spokeswoman for NAU.
Every year, we continually have to look at, you know, what does this look like and making sure that it's not always on the backs of students.
As students flock to NAU, developers have answered that demand. Apartment buildings have mushroomed both on campus and off. Flagstaff is an island surrounded by national forests, tribal, and state lands. There's nowhere new to build, leaving real estate at a premium.
We're in the top 1% of sheer number of beds offered by a university. So all of the other universities in the nation, the top 1% for providing housing.
So community members are working with the city and NAU to come up with ideas to mitigate the growth. Ideas like building a satellite campus, getting more students involved in the community so they care about it, and alleviating traffic with public transportation. A proposition on November's ballot would extend hours and frequency of city buses. If voters approve it, NAU will buy bus passes for students. Emily Melhorn is a spokeswoman for Friends of Flagstaff's Future. We spoke across the street from the Hub, one of Flagstaff's controversial new apartment buildings.
They might actually legitimately decide, I don't need a car here in Flagstaff.
Melhorn has 4 part-time jobs to live in Flagstaff. A nonprofit helped her and her husband buy a home. Others, like attorney Matt McReynolds, just can't put down roots here.
In Sholo, for what we're paying here for rent, we could have an actual home. We could afford to buy a home and have a mortgage and live that little chunk of the American dream with our family.
For some, it's just too much of a sacrifice for a view of the peaks. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
From the Education Desk. The Arizona Attorney General's Office and the Scottsdale Unified School District have reached a settlement in a civil lawsuit regarding district construction projects. KJZZ's Mariana Dale reports.
Scottsdale community members first raised concerns about how the district was rebuilding schools in 2017. The Attorney General's Office claims the district awarded contracts under the guidance of an unlicensed architect who also tried to unfairly sway the selection process. The court found the school district did not knowingly violate the state's procurement code. As part of the agreement, the district will give annual procurement training and pay $5,000 to the AG's office. This finding does not affect any possible criminal filings. The controversy decimated the district's leadership, leading to the departures of the superintendent, chief operating officer, and CFO. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Tempe.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras Desk.
Every year, thousands of Catholics make their way to a small town in Sonora, Mexico, to honor a revered saint. Many come on foot as part of their sacrifice to the saint. But ongoing highway construction between Nogales and Magdalena has made that journey more dangerous for some this year. From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Hermosillo, Mexico, Kendall Blust reports.
The streets and plazas in Magdalena de Quino start filling with peregrinos, or pilgrims, who make their way to this otherwise quiet city 2 hours south of the Arizona border. They come every October to celebrate the town's patron saint, San Francisco Javier. Vendors set up shops selling trinkets and sweets along the cobbled streets, and hundreds of tents are squeezed onto patches of grass around the town's church and chapel of San Francisco as people wait to pay their respects and touch a replica of the saint. It's a reclined statue of the brown-robed San Francisco, his hands resting on his heart. Pilgrims come from far and wide to make their mandas, or offerings, to the saint. Many come from nearby Sonoran towns, often walking more than 50 miles from the border in Nogales, Sonora. Others come from the Tohono O'odham Nation in southern Arizona. It sometimes takes these pilgrims several days to make the cross-border trek. And they come for all kinds of reasons. Olga Francisco is from the Tohono O'odham Nation.
We have a St. Francis that belongs to the family. So we take turns every 2 years to bring him over here.
Robert Wilcutt from Fort McDowell.
But I'm going through some surgeries right now. I'm surviving on stage 4 kidney failure. So, you know, I might need a little help too.
Renewing your faith and you're willing to sacrifice anything, you know, leave everything behind. And
that's 25-year-old Tracy Cook from Sells, Arizona. Sitting with her family on a shaded patch of grass, eating corn on the cob from a nearby vendor, she says she's been coming to Magdalena to honor St. Francis all her life.
From what I heard, when I was in my mom's womb, when she was pregnant with me.
But her mother, Gabriela Shirley, says road construction has made her family's trip to Magdalena more dangerous this year.
It was kind of scary. I mean, it was just traffic going too fast.
It's even worse for walkers, who often make their way along the highway's narrow shoulder. Ricardo Vasquez is the director of emergency and disaster attention in the state of Sonora. He says officials have warned pilgrims not to walk on the road, but they're determined to come pay their offerings anyway. The rugged walk has softened somewhat over the years. Ambulances and military Humvees with soldiers patrol the road where people are making their trek. And a Red Cross trailer is set up on the main plaza to assist the injured, though it stands closed on a recent Tuesday. Volunteers at other attention centers say they've been helping pilgrims for years. That's Francisco Guadalupe Mangues with the group Brigada del Sol. They attend to the basic health needs of travelers like dehydration, blisters, or minor scrapes and bruises. And this year's roadside conditions haven't stopped the flow of people making their way to Magdalena. Julia Lopez drove alongside her son and grandson as they slowly walked a rural side road Tuesday. She says the road construction is just one of the challenges her family faces every year making the pilgrimage from the Tohono O'odham Nation, but it hasn't stopped her yet.
And every year when this comes, I'm always like, how I'm going? I don't know, but I'm going. I've always been, had that faith like that, so we're here.
Especially because this year is an important autumn milestone for her 8-year-old grandson, Dimitri.
This is going to be my 4th year. It's going to be my family, pray with my family.
And when the festival wraps up at the end of the week, they'll all make the long walk back again, too. After all, Lopez says, it's tradition. Kendall Blust, KJZZ News, Hermosillo, Mexico.
And finally, from the Science Desk, here's KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis.
More than 4/5 of Americans live in urban areas, and city populations are growing faster than rural ones. Now, a new report looks at the impact urbanization could have on flu epidemics. Influenza cases tend to follow the same general pattern, rising in autumn, peaking in winter, and petering off in spring. But there's more to it than that, says Benjamin Diehl of Oregon State University, lead author of a paper in the journal Science.
In some cities, flu cases are consistently more evenly spread out throughout the season, and in other cities, more cases tend to occur within a smaller window of time.
Which pattern applies to your city depends largely on population density and humidity. In more crowded and populous cities, where packed living, working, and transportation spaces create regular chances for spreading, flu cases occur at a steadier rate. But in smaller, less crowded areas that also have wider humidity fluctuations, cases tend to cluster into a shorter time period, when flu-spreading droplets can survive longer. I'm Nicholas Gerbis in Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.